Imagine installing this like billion-dollar titanium bank vault door to protect your organization's most sensitive assets.
Right. Top of the line security.
Exactly. But then you just leave the factory PI'd as 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Over the last 90 days, roughly half the Fortune 500 did exactly that with their digital perimeters.
It's wild, honestly. It completely redefines our understanding of systemic vulnerability.
Yeah.
We spend so much time, you know, worrying about these highly sophisticated nation-state cyber attacks.
In movie stuff.
Exactly, the cinematic hacks. But the reality of global infrastructure collapse is far more mundane and honestly infinitely more terrifying.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a highly curated stack of intelligence from a recent Tick and Knight dispatch dated June 18th, 2026.
It's a heavy one today.
It really is. For those of you managing teams, investing capital, or just trying to understand where this whole digital landscape is heading, our mission today is to map out the fragile mechanics of digital trust and value. We're looking at how trust is built, how it gets aggressively monetized, and the spectacular ways it gets completely broken.
And we definitely have a lot of ground to cover. We are dissecting the largest enterprise network breach in history. We're watching a hawkish Federal Reserve instantly crush the crypto markets.
Yeah, it was brutal.
It really was. And then we're examining the mechanics behind a $1.8 billion crypto collapse. And finally, shifting into the brilliant, almost invisible economic strategies driving modern video game empires.
Quite the whiplash.
Yeah. But understanding the connective tissue between these events, you know, it gives you a massive advantage in seeing exactly where the tech sector is moving next.
Okay, let's start with that titanium bank vault door. We are looking at Fortibleed, and security researchers are categorizing this as the largest enterprise firewall breach on record.
The scale here is just, it's difficult to overstate.
Yeah, we have 73,932 unique Fortinet FortiGate firewalls globally that just had their plaintext credentials exposed. This spans 194 countries. It affects roughly half of all internet-accessible FortiGate devices on the planet.
The fallout is catastrophic.
Yeah.
I mean, this leaked database, it was discovered circulating in these underground forums by security researcher Bob Diachenko.
Right.
And it was subsequently verified by Hudson Rock. It contains over 21,000 unique IP addresses.
Who's sitting there?
Exactly. We are talking about major Fortune 500 companies, government agencies across more than 15 countries, and critical infrastructure operators, the people managing energy, water, telecommunications.
Okay, let's unpack this. The technical mechanics of how they pulled this off are what really caught my attention. Because the attackers didn't deploy some like mythical zero-day exploit.
No, not at all.
It wasn't some brand new invisible flaw that the manufacturer didn't even know existed. They essentially just jiggled the handles on every door they could find.
Basically, yeah.
It was this large-scale automated credential harvesting operation scanning the public internet for management interfaces. They exploited unpatched vulnerabilities, basic misconfigurations, and incredibly administrative accounts that were still using factory default passwords.
What's fascinating here is the recency of the data. That's the truly alarming part. The vast majority of the entries in this data set are time-stamped within the past 90 days.
Wait, really? So this is incredibly fresh.
Yes, very fresh. Threat actors were actively pulling device configuration exports from within the firewall's management interfaces while those organizations were just operating business as usual.
So if you're managing a corporate network right now, Fortibleed completely rewrites your threat model. Because, well, if someone compromises your firewall, they aren't just breaking into a server.
Exactly.
They essentially become the security guard.
And that is the crucial distinction here. A firewall is the arbiter of trust for a network. When threat actors hold those credentials, they can infiltrate internal systems, they can exfiltrate data, or deploy ransomware without ever triggering intrusion detection systems.
Because to the system, it looks like an authorized user.
Exactly. To the internal monitoring software, the malicious activity looks perfectly legitimate because it's being authorized by the perimeter defense itself.
That is terrifying.
It's a geopolitical nightmare, honestly. Right. A compromised firewall in, say, a developing nation's financial clearing system gives hostile actors a ready-made toolkit for economic sabotage that is practically invisible.
So the remediation steps laid out in the dispatch are, understandably, pretty severe. Obviously, if your IP is on that list, you initiate a full incident response immediately. But the structural fix demands zero trust segmentation.
Right.
Let's break that down mechanically. Basically, it means you stop treating your network like a castle with a hard outer wall and a soft interior.
You have to put vault doors inside the vault.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, zero trust assumes the perimeter is already breached. It requires implementing micro perimeters around individual applications and data sets.
So everything is locked down independently.
Exactly. It means lateral movement across a network requires constant, randomized 20-plus character passphrases and mandatory hardware token multi-factor authentication. Not just, you know, a text message to a phone. The era of the all-powerful firewall is just over.
Wow. Okay, so speaking of institutional trust getting breached, individual trust is just as easily exploited. Let's pivot to the dark side of digital finance.
Yeah, this is a tough one.
Rodney Burton, also known as Bitcoin Rodney, has pleaded guilty in a $1.8 billion crypto Ponzi scheme known as Hyperfund, which later rebranded to Hyperverse.
Right.
Operating from June 2020 to January 2022, they falsely promised the zero-risk daily passive return of 0.5 to 1% based on phantom crypto mining operations.
Completely fabricated.
Yeah. And Burton personally pocketed at least $7.85 million. He's facing up to 5 years in federal prison with sentencing set for July 23, 2026. But I have to ask, how does $1.8 billion get sucked into this?
It's a huge number.
We've all seen Ponzi schemes before, so why did thousands of people suddenly abandon basic math and trust a social media influencer?
Well, Hyperfund reached $1.8 billion because the broader economy was just flooded with cheap capital at the time.
Ah, right.
When interest rates are essentially at zero, people have money to gamble. They take massive risks because safe assets literally yield nothing. But they also used MLM referral structures to supercharge the growth.
Multi-level marketing.
Exactly. And they locked funds to prevent mass withdrawals, all while pushing this incredibly flashy lifestyle marketing.
Selling the dream.
Yeah. But the broader implication here is that federal agencies like the DOJ and the SEC, they are no longer just going after the architects of the schemes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they are actively prosecuting the influencers who market them. The era of crypto promoters operating with absolute impunity is over.
Which makes perfect sense. And the tide always goes out on scams like Hyperfund when the era of easy money ends, which perfectly explains the sudden market panic triggered by the Federal Reserve.
They completely altered the gravity of the financial markets in a single afternoon.
Yeah, June 18th, 2026. Crypto markets just tumbled after the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, made a decidedly hawkish debut.
Hawkish meaning his absolute priority is fighting inflation, even if it causes immediate pain for asset prices.
Right. So rates held at 3.5 to 3.75%. But the real shockwave came from the dot plot.
Dot plot.
For those of you tracking the macro landscape, this is the chart where each Fed participant anonymously projects where they see interest rates heading. And the market had been so confidently pricing in rate cuts.
They really were.
But instead, the dot plot showed 9 of the 18 participants projecting at least one rate hike by the end of 2026. Warsh bluntly stated the Fed is committed to delivering price stability above all else.
His tolerance for inflation running hot has just expired.
And the market repricing was violent. Bitcoin dropped 2.2% to $64,150. Ethereum dropped 3.6%, and MicroStrategy was down over 4%. But here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, yeah. The geopolitical disconnect.
Yes. Equities rallied hard on the news of the Iran peace deal. Defense stocks surged. The broader market loved it. But Bitcoin completely ignored global peace and sold off anyway.
Wait, isn't Bitcoin supposed to be digital gold? You know, the ultimate geopolitical hedge.
That reaction right there systematically dismantles the digital gold narrative.
Wow.
Yeah. The underlying mechanism of crypto markets is entirely dependent on liquidity. Monetary policy trumps geopolitics every single time.
Because it doesn't actually produce anything.
Exactly. Bitcoin is a zero-yield asset. It pays no dividends. It generates no interest. When the Fed signals a higher-for-longer interest rate environment, the risk-free rate of return on things like government bonds goes up.
So the money just moves. Capital mathematically flees highly volatile, speculative assets and flows right into those higher-yielding, safer alternatives. The Iran deal was great for global stability, sure, but it couldn't overcome the gravity of tightening financial conditions.
And the technical damage from that capital flight is severe. Bitcoin slipped briefly below $64,700, which is its 200-week moving average. That is a critical historical support level.
Violating that 200-week moving average puts Bitcoin on incredibly thin ice.
How bad could it get?
Well, if the price decisively breaks and holds below $64,000, you trigger algorithmic stop losses.
Right, the computers take over.
Exactly. These are automated trading protocols used by massive quantitative funds. When the price hits a specific floor, the computers automatically sell to prevent further loss.
Which just drives the price down more.
Right, which triggers the next set of computer algorithms to sell. That cascading pressure could force a rapid capitulation event, driving the price instantly down to the $58,000 to $60,000 range before human traders can even react.
Man, that is bleak. But while the crypto sector bleeds liquidity trying to prove its foundational value, the artificial intelligence sector is aggressively doing the exact opposite.
Oh, entirely.
They are proving their value by charging astronomical premiums for highly specialized trusted tools.
The enterprise pivot we are seeing from companies like OpenAI is probably one of the most defining business strategy shifts of the decade.
Leaked screenshots reveal OpenAI is testing a brand new vertical tier tentatively called ChatGPT for Science.
A very specific niche.
Right. It features integrations with massive academic databases like PubMed and Arxiv, native LaTeX support for rendering complex math, interactive molecular visualizations, and it uses their enhanced reasoning models like the O series and a new model dubbed GPT Rosalind.
But the actual headline is the pricing model.
Oh, yeah. OpenAI is pivoting hard to enterprise monetization. Institutional licenses are expected to cost between $500 and $2,000 per user per month.
Going from a $20 a month consumer subscription to a $2,000 a month enterprise license is just a breathtaking markup.
It's insane. It's like OpenAI realized they were selling reliable family sedans for $20 a month and just decided to build an F1 race car specifically for lab coats that costs a small fortune.
That's a great way to put it. But you have to realize they aren't just selling a faster engine. They are selling an armored convoy.
What do you mean?
Well, a pharmaceutical company or a university research hospital, they cannot legally or ethically feed proprietary patient data or unpatented chemical structures into a standard public AI chatbot.
Oh, of course. The data leakage risk.
Right. They aren't paying $2,000 a month just for a smarter AI. They are paying $2,000 for the legal liability shields and the compliance infrastructure built around it.
So the institutional friction is the actual product.
Exactly. These massive R&D departments require guaranteed IPR and GDPR compliance. They demand air-gapped data privacy protocols where their queries are absolutely not used to train future public models.
And I imagine uptime is a huge factor, too.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. They need service-level agreements that guarantee 99.9% uptime because their mission-critical workflows are now entirely dependent on this technology. OpenAI is just adopting the classic, highly profitable enterprise playbooks of Microsoft and Salesforce.
The software gets you in the door, but the compliance ecosystem locks you into the contract.
Exactly.
Okay, speaking of brilliant monetization strategies, sometimes the smartest way to extract massive value from a user base is to suddenly give something away for completely free.
It sounds counterintuitive, but it works.
Rockstar Games just unexpectedly announced that PS4 and Xbox One digital owners of Grand Theft Auto V can upgrade to the PS5 and Xbox Series X or S versions for free. They are completely reversing a previous 9.99 charge.
The timing here tells the entire story.
Right, because the goal is to migrate the roughly 2 million active PS4 players to next-gen hardware ahead of the massive July 2026 Court Center heist update and obviously the eventual release of GTA 6. So what does this all mean? Are they just throwing the players a bone out of generosity because we've been waiting for GTA 6 for literally over a decade?
Generosity, no. Corporate altruism is rarely the actual motive here. It's a highly calculated move to lock players into next-gen consoles where the ARPU is statistically much higher.
The ARPU, meaning average revenue per user.
Right. Statistically, players on current generation consoles like the PS5 spend significantly more money on microtransactions.
Because the game just runs better.
Exactly. The user experience is frictionless. Load times are nearly eliminated. The frame rates are smoother. The graphics are vastly superior. When you reduce the friction of the gameplay experience, player engagement time naturally spikes.
And highly engaged players buy more in-game currency.
Invariably. Rockstar is perfectly willing to sacrifice a tiny one-time $10 upgrade fee if it means moving millions of players into an ecosystem where they might spend $50 or $100 a year.
Wow. And beyond just boosting microtransaction revenue, I imagine the back-end cost savings are pretty massive, too.
Oh, huge. Consolidating the player base slashes their massive quality assurance and support costs for legacy platforms. Supporting a live service game with the sheer complexity of GTA Online across four different console generations requires an immense amount of testing.
Right, trying to optimize for a decade-old PS4 while utilizing a PS5.
It's a nightmare for developers. By forcing the consolidation now, they can systematically begin shutting down their legacy support pipelines, saving millions in development resources ahead of the GTA 6 launch.
So it's friction removal weaponized as a business strategy.
Precisely.
Well, while Rockstar builds long-term player loyalty through clever financial friction removal, Capcom is securing their player base through a totally different kind of value.
A very cool shift in strategy.
Deep, authentic cultural representation. Capcom just revealed Yasmin, the first DLC character for Street Fighter 6 Year 4, releasing August 3, 2026.
A highly anticipated release.
Yeah, she is a Filipino high schooler wielding a crescent-shaped karambit knife. And her fighting style utilizes eskrima, the national martial art of the Philippines.
The lore is pretty interesting, too.
Right. Her narrative involves searching for her lost brother, and she's actually inspired by FuTube videos of the SF6 supermodel fighter, Manon.
It really grounds her in the universe.
It does. But her playstyle is what's crazy. She's a fast-paced, rushed-down archetype with these devastating, close-range block-stun combos. Imagine trying to defend against a fighter who combines the relentless, rapid-fire movement of Cammy with the terrifying close-range trap of a specialized knife.
Yeah.
That sounds like an absolute nightmare to block.
It's going
to
shake up the meta for sure. But zooming out to the cultural impact, you know, the massive fighting game community, the FGC, has a huge presence in the Philippines, specifically in Manila and Cebu.
Huge competitive scene out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Yasmin represents a massive leap forward. Historically, representation in these global games has sort of been relegated to tokenism.
Like just giving a character a specific flag or color palette.
Right, or a single voice line in Tagalog. But the actual gameplay mechanics are completely generic. But unlike past tokenism, Capcom has clearly done the meticulous research here.
How so?
They've managed to integrate a centuries-old weapon-based martial art authentically into global competitive gameplay. The fluidity, the strikes, the unique stance transitions of Eskrima are authentically mapped to how she actually controls in a match.
That's incredible.
It really is. They are validating a massive segment of their audience by proving that their culture isn't just a marketing skin. It is a mechanically viable, deeply respected way to compete on the world stage.
That level of respect builds an enduring trust with a player base that translates directly into long-term franchise loyalty.
It really does.
And honestly, trust is the connective tissue for everything we've navigated today.
It absolutely is.
We started with the terrifying collapse of the Fortinet castle walls and the Fortibleed hack, highlighting how fast institutional trust evaporates when the basics are ignored. We looked at the $1.8 billion hyperfund illusion. We watched the Fed crush crypto liquidity, proving how monetary policy dictates global capital. We saw OpenAI's massive price tags for specialized truth. And finally, the brilliant ways gaming giants are keeping us engaged through economic strategy and culture.
It's a constantly shifting landscape. But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a lingering, maybe slightly unsettling question to mull over.
Let's hear it.
If a digital perimeter as trusted and ubiquitous as a FortiGate firewall can be silently compromised worldwide simply because organizations left the factory default passwords on, what other trusted digital foundations in your daily life are currently standing on a completely invisible house of cards?
That is definitely something to think about. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We invite you to keep exploring these topics, question the defaults in your own systems, and stay curious.